Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. As we speak, there are 29 men standing on trial in Kazakhstan. They have one thing in common, that they are allegedly followers of Salafi sect of Islam, the group authorities accuse of plotting the deadly June violence in the region of October this year. This is the latest episode of a long list of religiously motivated persecutions in Central Asia. Earlier, Tajikistan banned the Islamic political party, and Kyrgyzstan continues the state-sponsored campaign against what they call untraditional form of Islam. Discussion about religion is already extremely taboo subject in the remaining two Central Asian countries of Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan, where all religious-based movements are completely banned. In today's Majlis, our Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, we will discuss Islam in Central Asia. We explore groups which are banned under the pretext of being radicals and a threat to the society, look into the basis of the allegations against them and consequences of the state policies involving religion and religious practices in Central Asia. To discuss the subject, from London, I have Felix Corley, editor of Forum 18, a news service specializes in religion affairs in Eurasia. Felix, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you very much.
Very nice to have you, Felix. From Washington, D.C., Diloram Abdullayeva, native of Uzbekistan, who currently runs an NGO called Tashabbus, is joining us. Diloram, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you, Diloram. From Prague, joining us is Noah Toker, editor at Registan, who has recently authored a detailed report on radical groups in Central Asia. Noah, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
As always, Bruce Panier is joining us, who is the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog called Kishlak Awazi. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Always a pleasure.
Very nice to have you, ladies and gentlemen. Let's start with the latest developments from Kazakhstan. So these 29 men are on the trial. Earlier, there were reports that Kazakh authorities are banning Salafis. Later, it appears that the comment is being reversed. What is the latest, Bruce, from Kazakhstan on this context?
Well, as you mentioned, they got the people on trial right now. Their links to religious radical groups are pretty thin, to tell the truth. The basis for this seems to be that they listened to some radio programs or something like that and somehow became extremists from that. That said, the Kazakh authorities have known for several years that there's Salafi communities out in the northwest part of the country, in the oil areas of the country, and they've been monitoring them, but they haven't shut them down. But the stories that appear in Kazakh media are always kind of vaguely worded as, you know, men with long, unkempt beards, you know, who are extremely pious and potentially pose some kind of threat to society. And of course, a lot of the things that go wrong in northwest Kazakhstan, and remember this, again, this is like oil country and they have employment problems and a lot of other social problems. But every time these things seem to come up, the local authorities point their finger at these particular people and say that they must be involved in it. And this is what these are the roots of the problems that they're having out there. When, again, the evidence to support that is not very compelling.
Talking about the involvement of Salafis to October violence, Noah, as much as the October violence itself, the authorities' allegations against Salafis also raises eyebrow in connection to October. What are the proofs between the June violence and Salafis that you have come across so far?
Well, there aren't really any, because defining a group or defining a religious movement, defining the Salafi movement as if it were a single organized group that pursued some sort of agenda, is extremely problematic. It just doesn't work. I mean, we're talking about a very large theological movement that has many different organizations and many different groups inside it and many different tendencies. And it's been around since the 1920s, the early part of the 20th century. So it's very, very difficult, for example, for anyone in any of the Central Asian states, several of which have already outlawed Salafis, including Tajikistan, for them to define what a Salafi is. And for the most part, it appears that there is a purpose behind that. There's these laws and definitions of what it means to belong to this group are very loosely defined, and that allows the authorities to press basically anyone they want into this category and say that, you know, you belong to this group. Essentially, they're saying you belong to a group that doesn't actually exist. So it's very hard to prove they don't belong to something if you can't say what the group is in the first place.
Felix Noah raised a very interesting question on how to define Salafi, since you are specializing on implications of religious policies of the authorities on society. So is there any visible signs through which you can define the Salafis? I mean, just wondering how such decision might be implemented or can be implemented. You know, ruling a decision might be easy, but how to implement them without violating the human and or the religious rights of other people?
Well, indeed, this is a crucial question. Instead of looking at what have people actually done or what are they planning to do, which might harm the rights of other people, the authorities seem to be seeking people out because of their religious affiliation or their perceived religious affiliation or the form that their religious affiliation takes in practice or the perceived form. And this is a very dangerous approach which does nothing to help the security of the country and does nothing to protect the human rights of the people of an individual country. Salafism, as we've already heard, is not one monolithic movement. There's very many strands within it. There's very many forms of it. Some people who profess Salafi Islamic views are violent, but many of them are not. So how do you define it? If someone has a man has a beard, does that make him a Salafi? A lot of men have beards and many of them are not Salafis. So this whole area is very problematic. But the Central Asian governments are more or less saying religion is dangerous unless we, the authorities, have licensed it and registered it as being acceptable within very tightly restricted bounds which the government has set.
Dilaram, your country banned various religious groups. I mean, Uzbekistan. Talk through a little bit what has been the objective behind that and how much of those objectives, in your opinion, met?
There are many religious groups who are unofficially banned in Uzbekistan. Religious freedom is generally restricted in Uzbekistan. The restrictions come from unofficial state policy and some are prescribed by law. And restrictions target any religious group except the state-prescribed version of Sunni Islam. And that prescribed version is kind of Soviet-style Islam, I would say, closer to culture than religion. Other religious groups, including other branches of Islam, Salafi, Nurchi, Sufi, and non-traditional minority groups such as different denominations of Christianity, also face restrictions to right to freedom of religion. And the restrictions come to both having the conviction or belief, or also for practicing, manifesting, observing, worshiping. And this is seen mostly in registration and the manifestation of the religion with symbols and religious garbs. The excuse the government brings is mostly security-related excuses for the public order security. But if we go to the international standards and the laws of Uzbekistan, the restrictions for the religious freedom, especially for the article prescribed in Article 18 of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which states everyone has right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, this does not permit any limitation. This should never be limited due to public or any kind of, you know, excuses. Only Article 18, Paragraph 1 of International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which is freedom to manifest, worship, practice, and observance, may only be restricted when it meets certain criteria. And these are, first of all, must be prescribed by law, by the laws of national government. And we see in Uzbekistan, most of the case, it's not prescribed. It's unofficial policy. You go to the laws, it states other thing, and you go to on the ground, it's different picture. And it must be necessary to protect public safety, order, health, morals, and other fundamental rights and freedoms of others. And I would note here it says public safety, not security. I think there must be distinction between national security and public safety. And it cannot be used vaguely. It must be specific with a purpose, and it cannot be based on assumptions about the group or any practice. And in Uzbekistan, we see and the restrictions, measurements they take is mostly based on assumptions that this group or this individual may commit a crime, not based on a clear evidence of such acts. And it cannot be used in discriminatory manner or discriminatory purpose, for example, arbitrarily targeting one group or vulnerable groups, such as women. And we see it again in Uzbekistan with a ban on religious dress. The women who follow Islamic face discrimination because, you know, it's banned, special targets them.
How do you see this discrimination on the ground? I mean, a woman wearing a religious scarf, how she is being discriminated? Mm-hmm. In which ways?
The discrimination on the religious garb, religious dress, is partly prescribed by law with the Administrative Code of Uzbekistan, where it says it is illegal to wear religious dress in a public place. But then there is question about what is religious dress. It is not well defined, and there were statements by the Religious Affairs Council saying that it is hijab is not religious dress. But again, there are many cases where people are targeted because of their religious dress, and it is enforced in arbitrary manner. I would say, for example, if you go to Uzbekistan, you see people who are wearing headscarf on the streets, in bazaars, in public places, but not everyone else is. It's for the arbitrary targeting is to keep people in fear that, you know, you never be confident about practicing your religion, and you may be next by the police, you know, to be called by the police. So it is practiced arbitrary and to keep fear in people who practice religion.
Thank you, Dilara. Expanding the subject a little bit, looking into Tajikistan, Bruce. In Tajikistan, as you remember, the Islamic Party was blamed in orchestrating the September 2015 attacks against the security forces. Later, the party was banned and defined as a terrorist group, and hunt for its members started. How their members were identified and rounded up?
Well, I mean, it was a registered political party, so right. There would have been records. They had at least 40,000 people who had signed up as being members of the party. So it would have been pretty easy to find them, and certainly very easy to find the leadership because, of course, they had been out in public a lot of times. Some of them were, members of parliament, a couple of them. They were successful businessmen. So there was a lot of ways to identify them, certainly. That was easy. But I do think this is one of the worst, one of the most brutal examples of what happens to religion, because here was a, by all accounts, a fairly moderate group. It had participated in the civil war, but it had also been a participant in the peace process and a faithful participant in the peace process in Tajikistan for a long time. And for the Tajik government to just, really turn 180 degrees around and all of a sudden say, you're no longer a partner in the peace process or members of the government. And in fact, we now have evidence that you're an extremist group with plots to overthrow the government. I mean, it was astounding to watch this whole process happen. You know, Tajikistan has had problems with religious groups in some places, not members of the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, but they have had the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, for instance, had bases in there. And now that was a legitimately extremist Islamic group that was on the soil of Tajikistan. This other group that's shown up lately, Jamaat Ansarullah, is another example of a group which probably is extremist. But the Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan, you would have to look at that as purely a way of the government removing political opposition to itself in the same way it would remove a secular opposition group. It managed to use religion to remove this particular group from the political scene in the country.
The fallout of the crackdown against alleged plotters in 2015 seems still continues in Tajikistan. I was just watching a heartbreaking video story produced by our Tajik service today in which you see a middle-aged woman being kicked out of her home with four of her kids because the father of kids were accused of aiding the alleged September 2015 plotters, who is already placed in jail. The family is today, seems to me, surviving under the open sky. Please take a look. You can find the story and the video on Majlis's Twitter account called Majlis Podcast. Noah, Uzbekistan has been the scene for various types of religiously motivated persecutions, as Dilaram was describing. As we speak, our Uzbek service reports about new wave of religious persecutions. You are with our Uzbek service these days. Tell us, what is the latest?
Well, what we have happening now is a sort of second round of persecution that happened already. So our sources tell us that motivated by the pre-election period, temporary acting President Mirziyoyev will stand for election in early December. And according to sources within the security services, one of the things that he has ordered is particularly in border areas and within Tashkent for the security services to do house-to-house searches of people who were previously convicted on religious charges. Many times these were dubious charges, as Dilaram described earlier. And the security services are going back and tearing their homes apart. Masked men are without identifying themselves or entering the homes in early morning hours and pulling all their belongings out, ripping open sofas and mattresses and taking people away. In some cases, these are family members of people who are no longer in the country. And so it appears that this is meant to be a demonstration, a very purposeful demonstration, that while Mirziyoyev has signaled and his government have signaled that there may be some changes, some easing and some liberalization in some areas, particularly economic and in borders and international ties, that this is one area where he does not plan any change of course. I think it would not be an exaggeration to say that everyone who they suspected of having some sort of unauthorized religious affiliation or unauthorized religious belief, and this just means anything that doesn't subscribe directly to what's managed by the state, have already either been forced to flee the country or been arrested. Mm-hmm. And so now they're going back over and researching and reasserting control over people who have already been convicted and served time and been released.
Thank you, Nova. We are not talking about Turkmenistan at all today, not because that it has no such problem. On contrary, even discussion about religion can land you in jail there. So the situation is far worse in the country than any other country in Central Asia. Felix, what are the nature of pressure against believers in Turkmenistan compared to the rest of Central Asia?
Well, religious believers in Turkmenistan are under very, very tight government control. The state dominates the Muslim community. No other Muslim communities are allowed to exist apart from the state-backed muftiat. All other religious communities are controlled from outside, the Russian Orthodox, the Protestant churches, Hare Krishna community, Baha'is, and so on. Very, very restricted existence for all of them. But for the Muslims, for example, there are many prisoners held apparently because of their religious faith, and very little is known about them. Forum 18 recently published about Bahram Saparov, who led a group of Sunni Muslims in his home city of Turkmenabad, Jarju, in eastern Turkmenistan. He's believed to have received a 15-year prison term. He's in the top security prison in Ovadendepeh in the desert, and very, very few prisoners ever come out of there alive. And he's last known to have been seen in that prison in 2014. There were 20 of them, about 20 people who were imprisoned at the same time as him. He led just a small group of Hanafi Sunni Muslims who wanted to learn more about their faith and to discuss it and to grow into it, in a sense. And he was quite a figure who seemed to have gathered people around him, perhaps up to about 50, 60 young people. And he, you know, was punished. He faced constant harassment from the secret police because of this. And, you know, eventually they swooped on all of them or many of them, and they were imprisoned. But he's not the only one. I mean, there was an imam of a Sunni mosque in Ashgabad, Artur Atayev, who used the Muslim name Ali. He was in Khitrovka, which is a poor district in close to the center of Ashgabad, northeastern part of Ashgabad. He was arrested in September 2008. Just after an armed clash in that area, which seems not to have had anything to do with him, where he was not an organizer or anyone involved directly in it. And he died in labor camp 2 years ago, and they've never given his body back to his family for burial. So that's an extra form of course, an extra distress to relatives. But we hear so little about these types of prisoners. There was another Muslim from Turkmenabad, an ethnic Tatar, and he used to go around preaching in the town. He was quite a visible figure. He wore what were regarded as typical Islamic clothes, and, you know, he would stand up in the mosque and ask questions at Friday prayers and complain that the imams weren't warning people not to have pornographic films on their mobile phones, this type of thing. He was tried in 2008, given a 5-year prison term, and it seems that another 7-year prison sentence was added once he was already in prison. So, you know, we've had no information recently about where he is, whether he's still detained or still imprisoned, and where he might be. So a lot of secrecy. Families are often not informed about the trial, and the verdicts are not handed out. Trials are closed. This kind of secret justice is never good for anyone. It's not good for society. It's not good for actually making sure that the people who are prosecuted and ought to be prosecuted are brought to justice, and that the people who should not be brought to trial, or once they're on trial they should be acquitted, that does not happen. So secret justice is never good.
Thank you, Felix, for this insightful comment. Just to recap the debate today in the Majlis, RFRL Central Asia podcast, we are discussing Islam in Central Asia and move by the authorities against conservative Muslims or people representing various sects in the region. Discussing the subject with me are Felix Coley, editor of Forum 18, a news service specialized in religious matters in Eurasia, Dilorum Abdullayeva, native of Uzbekistan, who currently runs an NGO called Tashabuz, and Nova Toker, editor of Registan, is joining us from Prague. Also, Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Koshlak Awazi, is with us. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Majlis. Let's talk a little bit about the policies of the Central Asian governments against Islam or any other religion. Noah, you have had a very insightful analysis on that. How many groups or organizations were banned so far in Central Asia on the religious grounds?
To be honest, there are so many of them that I've never made a full count. Felix may know with the number off the top of his head, but I mean there are new ones all the time. And the other problem is, I mean, the part of this that is that is extremely problematic is, like I discussed before, some of these, particularly in Tajikistan, where they've been very aggressive about prosecuting people under legislation that bans Wahhabis and Salafis, are that these are categories almost without definition. You'd be very pressed to find anyone in a Central Asian government who could delineate to you the exact difference between a Wahhabi and a Salafi, and who could and lawyers who present these evidence in trial. There's very, very little effort to make any kind of definition. These are very convenient definitions for the governments that allow them to prosecute any suspects that they wish, which leaves it open to a lot of political abuse. But I want to look at that from the other side as well and say that actually it's very poor security policy. It's counterproductive. It's not helpful because it's not as if, as Bruce mentioned earlier, There are violent extremist groups. There are violent extremists and insurgent groups who have been active in Central Asia in the past and who are active at the moment in Afghanistan and Syria that have attracted not an incredible number, but a significant number of young Central Asians to come and join them, most of whom are pulled away to serve as cannon fodder in a foreign civil war and who lose their lives within a few months of being lured into joining one of these groups, and they many times are deceived into joining the groups, and so the governments would do their own citizens a favor in paying attention to public safety and the public good, as de la Rome stressed, by having definitions that actually work this case. By going, you know, you're not going from a public security perspective and from a public safety perspective, it does you no good to say we need to be worried about all the men who grow beards, because this is useless. I have a beard. Am I a threat when I'm in Kazakhstan? You know, I'm not a threat because I'm a white person and presumably I'm not a Muslim, so therefore I get to have a beard. You know, this is just, it's very poor policy. It's very poor security policy, especially when you have actual violent, organized insurgent groups who are trying to recruit members of your population to do acts of violence or to commit acts of violence on themselves. So what you need to do is narrow down the focus and look at the actual organizations that are engaging in violence and focus legitimate police efforts on those organizations and on their recruiting tactics and on their recruiting targets. And then at that point, you get policy that actually works. Not only do you protect the rights of ordinary believers, but you also get the bonus of doing your job as a state in protecting the lives of your citizens, not just from one another, from those who choose a criminal path, but protecting the lives of young people who are being lured into joining these groups where they go to their death and for really no purpose.
Thank you, Nova. Talking about policies, yes, it is ridiculous. It is repressive. I'm wondering how ugly can it get, Bruce?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, there's one thing we got to remember here is that the Soviet Union did a lot of things to upset the trajectory of Central Asia. And one thing is that we've inherited a generation of leaders who aren't very familiar with Islam themselves. They're not very familiar with the religion. And this has been a big problem with them in the past, before the Russians came, even after the Russians had just arrived. Peoples who were the emir or the Han or whatever their title was were also very deeply religious, or at least had been going to mosque since they were small children. Their whole lives they had been acquainted with the religion, so they had a better understanding of what Islam was all about, and they were in the better cases able to argue from an Islamic point of view and legitimize their own rule on that basis. These leaders were schooled in the Soviet Union. It was officially atheist. They don't know very much about Islam, and of course they view that as a threat. They know their own history of the region out there, and they understand that there's very few things that are likely to unify the people in their region. But religion is the one thing that opposition forces, opponents of the government are able to call upon and manage to attract a great number of people in the region. And at the same time, as I said, these leaders don't understand what the religion's all about. So for them, it's a double jeopardy for them. the fear of the unknown. And of course, they're supposed to be knowledgeable about these things. They portray themselves as being religious people. We see that in, Tajikistan, for instance, Rahmani, he makes the Hajj. Atambayev is always, they have his pictures taken when he's out there at namaz, doing the prayers. So, but in fact, they're fakes. They don't know. So it's terrifying for them to look at this. Mm-hmm. They probably, Noah was mentioning that they should make this distinction. But unfortunately, the leadership themselves probably can't make this distinction. They don't understand, who is a potentially violent and dangerous Muslim and who's simply a pious Muslim. And even the terms we've been using during this, this broadcast, Wahhabi, what is that? The Soviet Union used to talk about Wahhabis all the time. And then it resurfaced in Uzbekistan, 20 years ago. And Salafi is exactly the same kind of term. It's specifically Muslim who's essentially against the state policy. That's how they look at this person. It really doesn't even have a religious basis in it. So, this is the problem we got. They want to embrace the religion. They want to show their former colonial master, Russia, that they are not, mankurts, to use the term from Chinggis Aitmatov. But they are distinct culture and people that are not Russian colony, not Soviet Union. But like I said, at the same time, they want to embrace Islam and make themselves distinct. They fear it severely, and they're worried that will be what overthrows them in the end.
Well, it's also difficult to paint policies of the all governments with the same brush. There were some organizations, as Noah mentioned, which was clearly inciting violence, such as the IMU or Jundullah, Jamiatul Ansar, I think, Bruce, you mentioned. How would you deal with them who are clearly engaged in violence?
Well, I mean, once they are engaging in acts of violence, or once they are calling for acts of violence, then you can pretty much distinguish this group from the other ones. Hezb ut-Tahrir is a great example of one of these groups that doesn't really seem to present a huge threat to the state, except that it offers an alternative ideology to the ones that the state is promoting. So that is the biggest threat there. But Hizb ut-Tahrir, publicly says that they're not going to use violence. They do agree that the system needs to be changed, but they're not going to take up arms to affect that kind of change. But just that knowledge that this group has a different idea of how a government could work and implicitly opposes the government because they want them to be more Islamic and less secular is enough of a threat that the governments in the region have tried everything they can to shut them down. They're banned, and they're perceived as a threat. Karimov, when he was alive, would lump them together with groups that we knew were actually extremists, and say this is a plot from the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, the Islamic Jihad Union, and Hizb ut-Tahrir, even though there was no evidence to suggest that any of that was true.
Felix, let me play a little bit of an irritating role here. The fact that more and more people are joining foreign militants, militant groups from Central Asia, isn't that an indication that we should be giving some legitimacy to authorities' point of view that there is a genuine threat to be dealt with?
Well, I think given the very small percentage of citizens of Central Asian countries who are going to fight in Afghanistan or in Syria or Iraq or whatever, I mean, I haven't studied the numbers, and they're very difficult to get accurate numbers for anyway, but are there more than coming from European countries or other countries around the world? I don't know. But the main point remains: the government should look at people who are actually committing crimes of violence or inciting or organizing the committing of crimes of violence, and not target people solely because of their religious affiliation or their perceived religious affiliation. And the problem is that once this extremism bandwagon gets going, everything can be caught up in it eventually. And we see that, for example, in Tajikistan, not only have Salafis and Wahhabis been banned as extremists, but so have Jehovah's Witnesses. We see the same with a whole range of Muslim groups. We've already mentioned Hizb ut-Tahrir, who I believe do propagate very anti-Semitic and unpleasant sentiments about people, which are pretty unacceptable. But there are other groups. Tabligh Jamaat, for example, is a Muslim missionary movement. It was banned in Tajikistan. It's been banned in Uzbekistan, in Russia, and in Kazakhstan. We've seen no evidence that in Kazakhstan that anyone there connected with the movement has committed any violent crimes or called on others to commit violent crimes. But Forum 18 has counted 41 alleged adherents who've been convicted in the criminal courts since December 2014, and most of those have gone to prison, and the rest of them have got restrictive freedom sentences. Their literature has been banned there. We see one government after another copying the banned list. You know, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization shares these lists, and once someone is banned in one country, a group is banned in one country, they're very likely to be banned in all the other member states as well. We've seen, as we've already, I think Delora mentioned, the readers of Said Nursi, the Muslim theologian. They claim there isn't an actual organization, but the governments in the region call that Nurjullah and claim it's a very well-organized movement. Again, there's no evidence that we have seen that any of their people have been involved in violence or calls for violence. But they've been banned in Russia, in Azerbaijan, in Central Asia, Uzbekistan. There are many of their people who've gone to prison. So, you know, once something takes hold somewhere, then this extremism kind of, it's a kind of continual motion system that's been created. Their literature is banned as extremist. Therefore, if you've got their literature, you're an extremist. Because you're an extremist, then your organization should be banned as extremist, because the organization is banned as extremist, and anyone who has any contact with it is an extremist. So just the cycle goes on and on. Jehovah's Witnesses across Russia, they're being fined and their organizations liquidated and banned as extremists because they have Jehovah's Witness books which have been banned as extremist in Russia. So, you know, the cycle goes on. They banned access from Russia to their international website. You know, the cycle goes on and on. And where does it stop?
So what is the right balance here, that authorities do not violate the fundamental religious freedom, also do not compromise their security, Delora?
I agree with Noah in stating that religious extremists or acts of religious extremism are the result of the severe restrictions on freedom of religion in those countries, and it's not otherwise. And by restricting religious freedom, they're helping those extremist organizations abroad. For the proper policy would be to stop and think about the policy. Is it helping or not? Are we gaining or not? And then follow the established international laws, the laws it prescribes in the constitutions of those countries. And, you know, education, if there is real threat from the abroad, from organizations such as, you know, in Syria, in Afghanistan, then the proper way would be education.
Right. Thank you very much. Noah, we have spoken about lots of fault lines here, but what are some of the positive examples within the region in dealing with similar challenge groups?
Well, one of the biggest positive moments that's happened in the last couple of years is that as part of, or, you know, we believe as part of their anti-ISIS campaign, the government of Uzbekistan decided to release a prominent religious teacher and thinker named Hayrullah Hamidov, who was, up until he was arrested in 2010, was one of the most widely followed and influential young religious sort of celebrities. He was, in a way, he's not a trained cleric, but he was a disciple of the former Mufti of Uzbekistan, Muhammad Siddiq Muhammad Yusuf. And he ran a popular FM radio program and some publications and things like that. In a way, he was sort of the front end of a kind of religious celebrity of the type that we see in just about every society in the modern age. And he had very, very clearly non-extremist views. He made it very clear that he actually submitted all of the themes for his programs to the state muftiate before broadcasting and things like that. He really, in fact, never said anything very controversial. But at one point, he became so popular that I think it made the government nervous, and they decided to announce one day that he was the leader of a terrorist organization that no one had ever heard of before. And he and several other people who were close to him were convicted in a closed trial, like the ones that Bruce and Felix have talked about already. And, you know, we don't have a whole lot of idea what happened inside the trial, but he was convicted of being the leader of a terrorist organization and for, I believe, on charges of trying to overthrow the government, and sent away to prison and silenced that way. And then as the government began to realize, I think in early last year, that they were facing in ISIS an organization unlike anything that they'd faced before, especially because of its mastery of social media and the skill that its recruiters had in penetrating the firewalls and blocks and the sorts of things that Uzbekistan had erected to much success to cut out the voices of groups like the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan and people like that before. They agreed to release Khairullah, and he became briefly the spokesperson for the state muftiate's anti-ISIS campaign. And they released him, though, without ever taking back the charges that were made against him in the first place, which is, I thought, was really a travesty of justice. I mean, I applaud the government for releasing him. I think it was a wise strategy. It was a good strategic move. And he was a natural and logical spokesperson against a violent extremist group that the vast majority of Uzbek Muslims condemn and, you know, have nothing in common with. And he was a logical choice for that. And so the government did the right thing, I think, by choosing to have him as the public face for this campaign, for the anti-ISIS campaign. But I think it remains really emblematic of the government's approach toward religion that they did this. They made him the face of their anti-terrorism campaign without ever admitting that he was not a terrorist and without ever acknowledging that they had charged him with being the leader of a terrorist organization. He just went from one day being in prison as the leader of a terrorist organization, and the next day as the government's, you know, chief face sort of for their anti-ISIS campaign. And they never acknowledged the tension between those two things. And so although it was really a positive step, and I applaud them for doing it, and I'm really relieved that Khairullah was released, I still think it remains emblematic of the ground that they still have to cover.
Bruce, we are talking about some of the positive examples in the government's approach to deal with these things within the region. Anything that you would like to add into this debate?
There was a time, certainly in the 90s and at the early part of the turn of this century, when they did have qualified Islamic clerics there. There was no doubt about it. I met the old Grand Mufti of Uzbekistan, Bahramov, in the latter part of the 90s, and he did understand the religion. He was loyal to the state, but he absolutely understood what the religion was all about, and was trying to, like so many of them do, figure out a way that he could fit his interpretation of Islam in with contemporary events in this case Uzbekistan, but I've seen it's in other countries too. You know, that said, I think one of the biggest drawbacks they have now is that they've decided that they're not going to let their leading clerics go, or their future leading clerics leave the country to get education outside the country. Someone like Bakramov had received his Islamic education outside the country. There was a bunch of others that are still around actually today, but now they want all this stuff to be local, and it's obvious that their intent is to make sure that it's everything they learn is a state approved version of Islam, which they will then pass on to the worshipers in their own community. And this has always been the problem, is, you know, especially coming out of the Soviet heritage, is that people figure that these people, the leading clerics, are probably no more than state stooges, mouthpieces of the government. They're in place to give them a version of religion that keeps them loyal to the regime. You know, that really wasn't the case for a while there, and there still are some people that did receive their education abroad, but in the future generation or generations, I think it's going to make the problem much worse that that all these people will be educated in madrasas, which are located in the countries that they live in, and they will have hardly any experience outside the country, and their legitimacy will be questioned again and again.
Felix, the Central Asian leaders are facing more and more unusual realities when it comes to religion, partially because people are returning to their religious roots. The authorities, have the capacity to deal with this on their own?
Well, what's there to deal with if people choose to follow a religious faith or to be interested in religion or not to be interested in religion? That should be entirely their affair. It's not for the state to get involved at all. And I think the states find it very difficult to recognize this fact. The fact is that we live in an open, democratic world. These are the ideals that people aspire to. And the governments have been left behind. They're doing their own citizens a disservice by seeking to dragoon them, if they are religious, into a very tight, narrow box where they can conduct any religious activity under close state supervision. So the state has just got left behind by the modern world, where individuals can choose whether to believe or not to believe. And it's much easier now with the internet and with international contacts to get access to fellow believers and to information and to learn more about a faith if you are interested in doing so, or any belief system if you're interested in doing so. The governments need to wake up and catch up with this, but they are determined to hold the line and to try to prevent these kinds of developments within society.
Final point, Dilaram. So what role the international community can play to help the Central Asian leaders to come with the terms that, yes, that it's okay for its people to choose what they like to believe in, or if they don't like to believe in, they don't believe in?
I think there should be more and more pressure from international organizations such as UN, Human Rights Commission, and other international organizations and governments. When it comes to other governments, dialogue is important, I think. There should be constant dialogue focusing on human rights, especially religious freedom, because we see religious freedom is most restricted in those countries, and also encouragement with education or other, in other areas with partnership, so that, maybe exchange, maybe other ways, so that people have access to other world.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dilaram Abdullayeva, the chief of the Tashabbus, an NGO specializing in legal issues, legal matters in Uzbekistan. Also, big thanks goes to Felix Korley, editor of Forum 18, a news service specializing in religious matters in Euro-Asia. Noah Toker, editor at Registan, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, for your participation in the Majlis today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis. Until next week, bye-bye.